Imagine for a second, right, that you are walking onto the trading floor of a major Wall Street hedge fund. You're watching a portfolio manager sitting there at their terminal, and they calmly decide to take $12 million, drop it into a single highly illiquid asset, and lock it up for 10 straight years.
Yeah, with absolutely no way out.
Right, exactly. No ability to sell it, no way to adjust the position if the market completely flips tomorrow, just entirely stuck. You'd probably look at that manager and think, they were completely out of their mind.
Oh, Wall Street would laugh them right out of the building.
Exactly. But here is the wild part. That exact scenario, that rigid, locked-in $12 million bet, I mean, that is precisely how most chief financial officers are funding supply chain automation today.
It really is a massive blind spot in corporate finance. And, it is happening every single day. We are currently evaluating these 21st century logistics networks using tools that were, well, built for a completely different era of business, treating volatile environments as if they were perfectly predictable.
So, welcome to the deep dive. Today, we are exploring a really fascinating article from the May 2026 issue of the Supply Chain Management Review, written by Dr. Rizwan Manzoor.
That's a fantastic piece of work.
It really is. And our mission today is to figure out what it actually means to run a supply chain like a hedge fund. We're going to summarize the core arguments of the article, break down this groundbreaking framework Dr. Manzoor proposes, and look at the deep significance of treating volatility as a variable you can price and hedge against, rather than, a disaster that just breaks your budget.
Right, a predictable cost of doing business.
Exactly. Okay, let's unpack this. Why are the traditional ways we buy warehouse robots and conveyor belts suddenly so dangerous?
Well, to understand the danger, we really have to look at the underlying math that justifies these massive investments. For decades, traditional finance has relied on standard valuation formulas, right? Things like discounted cash flow, net present value, internal rate of return. Exactly, the classics. So when a company wants to build a $12 million automated storage and retrieval system, or bolt miles of fixed conveyors to a warehouse floor, the finance team builds a model. And that model typically assumes a static 10-year amortization period. It assumes the world tomorrow will look essentially like the world today, just projecting steady-state operations infinitely into the future.
So it's producing these incredibly neat, reassuring spreadsheets that just draw a straight line up and to the right.
Which looks great in a boardroom, but then reality intervenes. A new trade corridor opens 50 miles away, or a major port shifts its primary berth. Or, say, a sudden geopolitical regulatory change reroutes half of the freight in your region literally overnight. Suddenly, the physical infrastructure that your gleaming multi-million-dollar automation depended on is entirely obsolete for your needs.
And that $12 million conveyor belt is just.
Sitting in an empty room gathering dust. It becomes what is known in finance as a stranded asset. And we are no longer talking about extreme, one in a million black swan events here.
It's just Tuesday.
It's just the ordinary daily weather of logistics today. Dr. Manzoor highlights a massive scale of value destruction here, pulling McKinsey data that estimates supply chain disruptions can erode up to 45% of a company's EBITDA over a decade.
For anyone not living in financial reports, EBITDA stands for earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization. Basically, it's a company's core operational profit. So wiping out 45% of that over 10 years is catastrophic.
It alters the entire trajectory of a business. And that massive profit erosion happens because the financial models used to approve these projects just haven't evolved in 40 years.
It honestly sounds like signing an ironclad 10-year lease on a massive blockbuster video storefront right as streaming video is being invented.
Oh, that's a perfect way to put it.
Like, the spreadsheets for the store probably look phenomenal. The projected foot traffic is modeled out perfectly. But the reality of the consumer market is rapidly moving out from under you. You're optimizing for a world that's already vanishing.
That analogy hits the core of the problem perfectly. Traditional capital budgeting treats a warehouse in a highly volatile, shifting logistics corridor exactly the same as one in a totally stable environment.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, it applies the same baseline financial expectations, what we call hurdle rates, which is just the minimum return a company expects before putting money into a project. The word flexibility doesn't even have a cell in that spreadsheet. A fully automated fixed conveyor system is evaluated using the exact same metrics as a fleet of autonomous mobile robots that you rent month to month.
That's crazy.
It is. The traditional model completely ignores the fact that one can be packed up and moved across the country in a week, and the other requires literal jackhammers to remove.
But, you know, knowing how chaotic the world is doesn't actually help if you don't have a way to measure it against your operations. Like, you can't hedge against a risk if you haven't quantified it.
Exactly.
This is where Dr. Manzoo introduces the solution, a framework called the Volatility Adaptive Automation Portfolio, or VAAP. And he starts by creating an actual numerical score for chaos called the VIX-SC.
Yeah, so the VIX-SC acts as a supply chain volatility index. It scores the operational chaos of your logistics nodes on a scale from 0 to 100. What makes it robust is that it isn't based on a logistics manager's gut feeling. You know, it combines three very specific inputs.
Okay, break those down for me.
First, it looks at internal forecast error. So the actual standard deviation of how wrong your own demand and lead time forecasts were over the last 12 months.
That's humbling.
It really is. Second, it factors in external infrastructure risk. They scrape public procurement portals to track government infrastructure delays.
Right.
They monitor port congestion data and integrate political risk ratings.
So it blends the internal messiness of your own company with the external messiness of the world.
It absolutely has to. If you only look internally, you might miss a looming port strike 50 miles away.
Yeah.
But to complete that picture, they pull in a third input, which is market-implied volatility.
Okay.
They use data like the GEP Global Supply Chain Volatility Index. Just to contextualize this, a VIX-SC score of 20 means your environment is relatively calm.
So 20 is good.
Yeah. But in April 2026, the global GEP index stood at 0.57, which is firmly stretched. And in Asia, it was hitting 1.16, indicating severe capacity strain.
Okay, so if I have a chaos score of 0.57, all right, 0.57, what do I actually do with that number? Because without a way to apply it to my actual warehouse, it feels like I'm just putting a precise scientific measurement on my own panic.
Well, that brings us to the internal audit side of the framework. You pair the environmental chaos score with a flexibility score for your actual equipment. It's called the Delta Auto score, and it ranges from 0.0 to 1.0.
It's like a grading system.
Exactly. Every single automation asset in your portfolio gets graded. A 0 means it is completely rigid, and a 1 means it is perfectly flexible.
The article gives a really clear, finance-friendly checklist for how to grade this, which I actually really appreciate.
Yeah, it's very practical.
Right, like, can the asset be relocated within 30 days? If yes, it gets points for flexibility. Does it have a secondary market resale value of more than 50% of the original purchase price?
Is the contract duration under 2 years?
Right. Is the hardware modular, featuring hot swappable components? So if I have a fleet of autonomous mobile robots, AMRs, roaming my warehouse on a month-to-month robotics as a service contract, my Delta Auto score is a perfect 1.0.
Spot on.
But if I have a custom design conveyor bolted into the concrete running proprietary software on a 10-year lease, I get a big fat 0.
What's fascinating here is how this entirely changes the nature of risk assessment from a static guess to a dynamic strategy. Dr. Manzoor cites a 2026 working paper by Trep Dye and colleagues that really proves the math behind this.
I was looking at that study, yeah.
They compared two approaches to infrastructure investment. In one approach, a company uses worst-case scenario analysis. They get terrified by potential disruptions, build massive, rigid warehouse capacity to handle the absolute peak doom and gloom scenario, and then take huge losses when that extreme scenario doesn't actually happen.
Because they spent $50 million preparing for a hurricane that just never made landfall.
Precisely. But the other approach treats investments as sequential, real options. You build a smaller, modular hub today, and you pay a slight premium for the option to expand it later if demand actually materializes.
Making it a phased approach.
Right. And the TREPT study found that evaluating investments as these sequential options creates expected financial losses that are 3.6 times lower than using the traditional worst-case analysis. It mathematically stops companies from overreacting to fear.
Wait, I have to push back on this a little bit. A flexibility score of 1.0 sounds amazing on paper, and the TREPT study makes a great case for modularity, but doesn't a CFO want some rigid, highly efficient systems?
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, when the waters are calm, a fixed conveyor belt will move boxes way faster and at a much lower unit cost than a bunch of rented robots. Is the goal here really just to put everything on wheels and avoid committing to anything?
That is the exact right question to ask, and the answer is absolutely not. You do not want a portfolio that is 100% flexible all the time, because flexibility costs a premium.
Right, you're paying for that optionality.
Exactly. Spot capacity, which is just buying temporary logistics space or power on short notice, is always more expensive per unit than a long-term lease. You sacrifice some baseline efficiency for adaptability. The goal of the VAT framework isn't to be entirely on wheels. The goal is alignment.
Meaning you only pay for flexibility when the environment demands it.
You got it.
Which means the math has to eventually lead to a trade. We have to connect the external chaos score to the internal equipment score. And the core rule of this framework for dynamic rebalancing is incredibly elegant, honestly. Your target portfolio delta auto should equal your VIX SC divided by 100.
That is the formula that acts as the trading floor of this entire operation. Let's use the real numbers from April 2026 to see how it works. If your regional volatility index is sitting at a calm 20, your target portfolio flexibility should be 0.2.
Meaning 20% of your assets are flexible, but 80% are rigid, highly efficient, bolted down systems.
Right. You maximize your margins because the stable environment supports them.
But if you are looking at the global average from that same month, which was 0.57, your target flexibility jumps to 57%. You need a much more balanced mix to hedge against the volatility.
And if your actual portfolio deviates from that target by more than plus or minus 0.15, the framework dictates that the CFO has to actively rebalance.
Rebalance how?
Well, you have to sell off rigid assets on the secondary market or go out and acquire flexible capacity to get back to your target ratio.
Which brings us to a concept that honestly feels like it belongs on a Wall Street trading desk, not a warehouse floor. Automation swaps. This is the actual mechanism for acquiring that rapid flexibility.
The automation swap is where operational flexibility literally becomes a financial derivative.
Here's where it gets really interesting. In an automation swap, a shipper pays a fixed monthly fee to a robotics as a service provider. But that fee isn't a standard equipment lease. It's an option premium.
Exactly.
By paying that low baseline fee, the shipper gets the contractual right to scale their robotic capacity up or down by 300% on just 2 weeks' notice. And if they execute that option, they pay a variable rate that is tied directly to the VIX SC index.
Which is wild.
We are turning operational capacity into a traded derivative. We are hedging robot capacity the exact same way airlines hedge jet fuel prices to protect themselves against price spikes.
It is a profound shift in risk management, but it raises a mechanical question. You know, how does the robotics as a service provider manage that massive fluctuation without going bankrupt themselves?
Right.
I mean, if they guarantee a shipper can scale by 300%, they have to have those robots sitting around somewhere, right?
I was wondering the exact same thing. It feels like you're just handing a live grenade to your vendor.
The secret is risk pooling across uncorrelated markets. The Reyes provider is managing a massive fleet across multiple clients, industries, and geographies.
Oh, so they balance each other out.
Exactly. When a retail shipper is experiencing a massive holiday spike and calls in their swap option to get more robots, an agricultural parts shipper might be in their dormant season and returning robots to the pool.
That makes a lot of sense.
The robotics network takes on the volume risk because they have the scale to balance it. The shipper pays a premium, the swap spread, for the privilege of not carrying that risk on their own balance sheet. You've taken the unpredictable threat of supply chain volatility and turned it into a transparent, managed risk.
So we have the math and we have the financial instruments, but what does this actually look like when you try to explain it to a boardroom? I mean, getting a company to change how they spend $50 million is a cultural challenge, not just a mathematical one.
It is often the hardest part of any transformation. Dr. Manzoor brings up a 2025 global study of 350 CFOs that really highlights the cultural friction here. 67% of those CFOs reported that their current digital investments are underperforming expectations.
Ouch.
And at the exact same time, only 15% of them viewed the supply chain as a priority knowledge area.
That is a brutal combination for an operations manager. You have finance leaders who don't fully understand the ground level nuances of the supply chain, and they are already burned by past technology investments failing to deliver.
It creates a massive credibility gap.
Right. If I'm an engineer asking for new technology, the CFO is naturally going to view me with suspicion.
And that is the true hidden power of the VAP framework. It serves as a translation tool. It gives the logistics engineers and the CFO a shared vocabulary Suddenly, operations isn't just asking for cooler robots to play with. They're talking about volatility exposure, delta scores, optionality, and hedging.
Using the CFO's own language.
Exactly. These are concepts that a finance suite intrinsically trusts and respects.
The article lays out a very clear 4-step implementation plan that embeds the shared language into the company culture without requiring a massive team of high-priced consultants.
Yeah, it's very straightforward.
Step 1, the chief data officer or the treasury team takes ownership of calculating that VIX SC scorecard every month.
Okay.
Step 2, supply chain finance creates a ledger tracking the Delta Auto score of all existing assets.
Setting the baseline?
Exactly. Step 3, the CFO sets the target ratio and issues rebalancing memos if things get out of whack. And step 4 is where it gets real. Procurement steps in to enforce it.
Grounding this in a human scenario really shows how powerful that 4th step is. Imagine a procurement manager receives a request from the operations team to sign a 10-year lease on a massive custom conveyor system. Before this framework, that decision would involve endless boardroom politics, arguments about efficiency, and guessing about future sales.
Lots of friction.
But with step 4 in place, the procurement manager simply looks at the asset's Delta Auto score. They see its scores as 0.2, meaning highly rigid. They look at the current volatility index, realize the company can't take on any more rigid assets right now, and legally kick the contract back to operations.
Saying, you know, this is too rigid for our current portfolio target. You must negotiate an exit clause or switch to a modular vendor.
Exactly. It completely removes the emotion and the politics from the capital budgeting process.
That is so powerful.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, what Dr. Manzoor is arguing is that the companies that win the next decade will not necessarily be the ones with the absolute fastest of conveyor belts or the lowest possible unit costs during stable times. The winners will be the companies whose CFOs learn to see operational flexibility as a distinct, measurable financial asset.
They will view optionality as a necessary hedge for survival. So let's make this practical for you, the listener. If you're listening to this and you're prepping for a meeting tomorrow with your operations team or your finance director, how do you respectfully point out that the traditional spreadsheet everyone is staring at might be lying to you about a new warehouse investment?
You start by shifting the core question of the meeting. When a spreadsheet is put on the table, the immediate instinct of every executive is to ask, what is the return on investment of this project?
Right, the ROI.
You need to interrupt that pattern. Ask, how does this investment change our ability to adapt when the infrastructure beneath us shifts? Ask what the secondary market resale value of the asset is. Ask what happens to the return on investment if regional volume suddenly drops by 40% next year.
Really challenge those assumptions.
When you force the room to answer those questions, the illusion of the static spreadsheet breaks down very quickly.
It forces everyone to admit that the 10-year projection is just a highly educated guess.
Exactly. It moves the conversation away from false certainty, which is dangerous, toward probability and risk management, which is how the real world actually operates.
So what does this all mean? To distill everything we've covered today, the days of funding a supply chain like a static, fixed factory are over. Logistics networks are now volatile trading floors. And success doesn't mean building the biggest, most efficient fortress. It means paying a calculated premium for the option to pivot when the ground shifts beneath you.
It requires a fundamental mindset shift from maximizing pure efficiency to maximizing adaptability.
And for you listening, this mindset isn't just for global logistics. Think about your own industry. Whether you're in software development, retail strategy, or healthcare administration, we are all operating in fast-changing environments. Locking into rigid 10-year plans based on best-case scenarios is almost always riskier than paying a little extra upfront for the flexibility to change your mind later.
The static spreadsheet provides comfort, but optionality is what actually ensures survival.
This raises an important question, though, something to really chew on that goes beyond the mechanics Dr. Manzoor wrote about. If thousands of shippers all adopt this hedge fund framework, if every major company starts buying these automation swaps to push their volatility risk onto the robotics as a service providers, what happens when a massive, truly global shock hits? Think about a new pandemic or a synchronized global trade war where uncorrelated demand disappears. What happens when every single company tries to exercise their option to scale capacity by 300% at the exact same time?
That is the ultimate stress test of any derivative market.
Right. Can the Reyes network actually absorb that kind of synchronized panic, or are we just moving the systemic risk further down the line until the robotics providers themselves default?
When everyone runs to the same side of the boat, the pool of risk disappears and the system breaks. It's a brilliant question to leave on.
Definitely something to ponder the next time you're looking at a 10-year projection that seems just a little too perfect. Remember, whether it's a $12 million stock portfolio or a warehouse full of robots, locking it away and closing your eyes is never the safe bet. Have a great rest of your day, everyone.